Weather for the KRVS listening area, locally sunny with a high near 87 today, southeast winds at 5 miles per hour, partly cloudy skies this evening with a low of 67. A 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms creeping into the picture tomorrow afternoon, and about a 20% chance, and high tomorrow reaching 89. Currently, it's fair and 85 here on the campus of UL Lafayette. Right now, we're going to head into the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
With me in the KRVS studios this afternoon, I'm delighted to say, are Lee Gray, curator at the Hilliard University Art Museum, and artist Sean Major, who has an exhibit that has opened up today. I guess to the public, it's fully up. I'm just so excited to have you here to talk to you about your work. I've admired it for so long, and I know many of our listeners have as well. And now we have the opportunity to see a collection of your work in Gallery A, in the larger gallery at the Hilliard. Before we talk specifically about Sean's work, Lee, maybe you can give us a sense of the scope of all these exhibits that are opening up this month at the Hilliard.
Okay. We have quite a number, and I just want to make sure everybody understands, too, that this was part of our bicentennial celebration. So we did the entire year based on Louisiana art and artists. So this is kind of the culmination, and we brought it home, and, you know, we're really just pleased to have so many artists participating this fall. So the first one, as we mentioned, is Rhyme and Reason, the Art of Sean Major, and it did open actually on Saturday. It's open now. Louisiana Voices, Six Artists Speak to Us. That's also open currently. Aquarellis, I can't say that, but it's watercolor in French, Louisiana watercolorists, and most of them are, it's across the state, most of them belong to the Louisiana Watercolor Society. And then we have a solo artist, Ken Katara, who is doing Viaticus.
So quite a collection. I've just been amazed at this set of exhibits. You always have wonderful exhibits, but the museum is going to be absolutely packed this fall with great exhibits. Now, tell us a bit about what your... I'm going to let you talk about Sean before I talk with her. I'm going to let you really make over her work. What do you like about Sean's work?
I love texture, and my background is in fiber arts, and so there was an immediate resonance for me because I used to do big, large felt-made pieces. And so, you know, immediately I saw a kinship in that. But I think also just texture. Very few artists work with a lot of texture. And so that's, you know, obviously the first thing you see with her work and color. So those two things, I think, or maybe three, were the first things I noticed. But the other thing is that she does something that's really unique, and that is always very special to me because I see a lot of art and a lot of artists. So when something makes me stop, you know, in my tracks and say, whoa, I haven't seen this, that's really special to me. So I kind of took note as soon as I discovered Sean, I, you know, kind of watched out for her.
You know, that's interesting that you say not many artists use texture. It seems to me that's one of the first things we try and entice children with, are like little texture balls and make them touch, you know, furry things and fuzzy and sharp. And but after that, texture isn't quite as important, is it, in art and creation? We talk about color and form. And but you're right, texture is so much a part of her work. Now, you are a Louisiana artist, Sean.
That's correct.
You're from New Iberia?
Yeah, originally from New Iberia.
And we were talking earlier before we got on mic about the amazing group of artists that you are a part of here at UL, or who were at UL around the same time you were. Probably it was USL back then?
Yeah, it was USL. I went to school with some great people, lots of artists that are known right now, Stephanie Patton and Brian Guidry and Troy Duga and Ralph Bork. It was an exciting time at UL when, you know, particularly Alan Jones's class.
Mm-hmm. He was a painting teacher.
Yeah, the painting teacher. Yeah. That's right. That's
well, mention some of the professors who were here at that time that many of our listeners I know.
Well, Elmore Morgan, of course, and Tom LaDusa and Dickie Wagner and Linda Fries and Fred Packard. It was a good time. It was really good for me.
Mm-hmm. Tom Sechrest.
Tom Sechrest, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And he mentioned Alan Jones. So a really amazing array of professors whose art was all very unique as well. You know, very distinctive.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And each one of the artists that you were mentioning, Ralph and Stephanie, and their styles are completely unique, but at the same time, very intense. There's an intensity to each of their styles. We're talking about Troy Dugas, who has a piece in our kitchen. Real interesting collages. He uses labels, product labels.
That's right. And Troy's also going to be opening in the B Gallery in a group show at the same time as my show opening this Friday.
All right, that's right. He's part of the six Louisiana artists.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I'll look forward to seeing those pieces. Well, tell us about what, amidst this group of professors and very talented students that you're with, how did you begin creating your own direction? What attracted you in these classes you were taking?
Well, I think it goes back to when I was an undergraduate, Alan Jones encouraged us all to experiment, and we all did. And I think in those days, most of us were using acrylic paint, and acrylic paint is a kind of plastic. And I loved the fact that you could stick anything into it. So to create texture, like you were just talking about, I started sticking objects into it. And then by the time I graduated, my work was still acrylic-based, but it was full of objects. So between undergraduate and then graduate school at Rutgers, I dropped paint and just used the objects because the objects spoke to me more than acrylic paint. To me, acrylic paint was really about art history mm-hmm. within, you know, the last 50 years or whenever it was invented. Mm. But objects, particularly, you know, personal objects or things that had lived with someone for a long time, they brought stories to me and, you know, seemed to relate to the real world.
Mm-hmm. So the acrylic paint was just like a colorful glue for you.
Well, at that point it was, mm-hmm. you know, but that doesn't mean that I don't appreciate a really good, I love especially large abstract paintings. Some of my favorite artists are abstract painters. But it wasn't working for me at the time. I mean, it wasn't talking to me anymore. I think, you know, and then at that point, I had to come up with a method of connection, right? Because I wasn't going to use acrylic paint anymore, and I wasn't going to glue things because I didn't think that said anything about my experiences, and I wanted everything involved in my art to have a voice. So I thought, well, what can I do? I mean, if I was working with wood, I guess nailing stuff, that could have been, you know, one way to go. But I finally decided that I was going to sew because it was something that I had always done as a kid. You know, even though I was saying this to somebody the other day, I can't use a sewing machine. I can't make clothes. I can't, you know, but I sew like 4 hours a day, you know, on my work normally, unless I got a big show coming up.
What did you sew as a child?
I was always making stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
stitching together things.
Yeah, I made dolls, and I made all kinds of things. So it felt really natural.
Now, I wanted to, for those people who have not seen your work, when you said
right.
you sew all of them, I know some of them are very large, they're extremely yeah. intricate, there are lots of different kinds of items. You sew all of those objects onto
yes,
the
I guess I should describe the work
yes.
because this is radio, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some people have called them mixed media tapestries, but I don't know if they really relate to tapestries so much because they're not woven, but normally it's some kind of first layer of clothing or sometimes paper or plastic, and then on top of that, thousands of objects are sewn onto it. So
describe some of those objects. Again,
I use a lot of toys, mm-hmm. actually. Lately, I've been using a lot of toys because that relates to, I think when you're a child, you set up a lot of your paradigms for later in life, even if you fight against it later, try to get rid of it, or it's still sticking in your head all your, mm-hmm. you know, whatever your parents believed in, even if you are completely opposite now, it still mm-hmm. sticks.
Well, sometimes when you see really fascinating kind of claymation films about dreams, there are a lot of toys in those dream sequences hidden, you know, in rooms and places. And they stay with you, little toys. So are these tiny toys, big toys? What size are these objects?
Well, normally I'll use anything I can sew is what I usually think. And if I'm going to use, you know, like a crochet thread or something, it's got to be an object that's light enough to sew. I mean, I could do something where I used heavier wire, or, you know, maybe if it was like an outdoor piece or something. But I think often I have to think about the weight. Now, there's a couple of large pieces in the museum right now that are 9 feet by 14 feet, and they're pretty heavy. But the objects are, you know, all over the piece, and they're smaller, so...
I know some people are trying to imagine how you sew pieces that large and that heavy, I'm sure, after a while. Do you have some kind of frame that you put them on, or is it in pieces?
No, I work on it like it would be a painting. It's on the wall, and I have scaffolding. And if it's a large piece, I use the scaffolding. But I work over the whole thing at once. And, you know, often people ask me how long these pieces take. And depending on the size, it's never less than 6 months, but it can be up to a couple of years. In some cases, it has been more. But I never work on a table or anything. I have to see it as I go. I have to work over the whole piece.
Mm-hmm. Where does your idea for a piece come from? What do you start thinking about? What drives you towards starting another piece? Is it color? Is it an idea? Is it some kind of philosophical idea? What starts happening in your mind when you approach a new tapestry piece?
Well, I think it varies a lot, and sometimes it is color, because I'm really interested in the psychological effects of color. So sometimes I might start off that way. I might think, you know, okay, for instance, red. People react to red because it's like you have, actually your eye can detect red. There's more detectors for red than any other color because it's, I think it's like about fear or blood or, you know, passion. So I might start off with a simple, you know, just as a way in. I never know what a piece is going to look like by the end, but I usually have a feeling of how I want it to feel. So that's when I know when it's ready and it's done. I often set up rules. I think I'm going to use these kinds of objects or this color for a while of objects, or I'm going to, you know, it might be linear for a while. But I think at a certain point, I usually break the rules. But I think you have to have some rules to start off with. And I think almost any artist would, you know, say you need some parameters.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I don't know where it's going to go all the time. Sometimes I only get, it's like you're walking with a flashlight at night and you only see a little bit of the path at a time. It's like that. And I think as you grow as an artist, you trust yourself more and more, and you say, okay, I only get this little bit at a time, and I'm gonna do it anyway, and I'm gonna see what's next.
I want to tell people who may just be tuning in and finding themselves fascinated by what you're describing. My guest is Sean Major, and there's an exhibit opening at the Hilliard University Art Museum called Rhyme and Reason, The Art of Sean Major. I mean, I ask it because, I mean, as a lay person, I stand in front of a piece like yours, and I'm in awe and have no idea how it starts, how it continues, how you even decide how it's finished. But it is utterly fascinating, and like Lee, I'm just amazed by the textures, and they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. And I ask, too, about whether you have some kind of idea or philosophical or literary, because you have really great names, titles for your pieces, and some of the names seem to come from mythology and stories. And are those titles in your mind as you approach a piece, or does that come later?
Normally, the titles come later, and I don't think about titles as defining the piece. Mm-hmm. I think about titles as existing next to the piece, you know, or alongside the piece. And I'm really interested in mythology, and I'm interested in people's stories, you know, and how, especially stories of how they explain, you know, what they're dealing with in their lives. Because I think all the work is about how we create our reality. Now, what I mean by that is, I think, you know, we can all look at the same situations and we're still reading it in a completely different way because of what we picked up as a kid or along the way. And, you know, I originally was thinking of these pieces as filters, and you know, as you get older, your filters are clogged really with like all these experiences that you had before, and maybe at a certain point, and my work is getting thicker, so I think it's reflecting that. At a certain point, maybe you just see the filter, you know.
Well, you know, if my filters were clogged as beautifully as your tapestries, I would be really happy.
but they are.
Well, and maybe you're making that clear to us, that we all have those lovely things, those bright, lovely things that are just, you know, impacted inside of us. You're just kind of making them visual. When you decide, I mean, I look at them and think, where do you get all of these things? I mean, I don't have those.
That was a question this morning. Where does she find all this?
Find them. I mean, you know, I collect little things I see along the sidewalk or, you know, periodically. But
people often ask me that. A lot of people give me stuff.
Now that, of course, they know over the past many years that you do collect.
Yeah, there's people that save stuff for me. Mm-hmm. But also, I buy nowadays, I buy a lot on eBay. Mm-hmm. I used to do, you know, garage sales and that kind of thing more, but mm-hmm. it takes a lot of time. And eBay, you can get stuff from all over the country.
Like collections
country
of toys,
yeah,
buttons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, especially if I can get large amounts, mm-hmm. you know, of things. And, you know, sometimes I buy things new, but normally I like to have stuff that has lived in the world already. But I want to go back to what you said a minute ago. I think, you know, about how if your filters were as lovely, I think these pieces, they usually have surprises in them. I think mm-hmm. I like them from a distance to feel like an abstract painting, and, you know, there would be, I hope there would be beauty, and, you know, you're attracted to it. And then when you get close, then you see things that are a little bit more, make you more uncomfortable. You know, like, and also I use a lot of symbols. So I think every time there's like insects in the work, I'm thinking about mortality, you know, so there's things like that. So it's never all wonderful and beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like if you're looking at somebody else's life and you're like, wow, they really have it all, you know, but if you're like maybe really knew them or lived in their shoes, you know, mm-hmm. then maybe you wouldn't think that.
So you have insects sewn in there as well.
Well, they're plastic insects. I don't.
Let me guess. There are a few plastic roaches, maybe.
Well, you know, I can't deal with plastic roaches, really, because I don't like roaches at all, and they freak me out.
Right. So that's a part of Louisiana culture that you don't include.
I don't, yes.
In your tapestries.
That's right. That's right. That's just a little personal
thing. Shawn Major
thing.
Reveals her phobia. Are there other things you just simply can't include in your tapestries?
Well, you know, I mean, some symbols like that. I don't know. That's probably.
Had to ask about that.
But
one,
I don't.
Didn't I?
You know, but there are things I don't include. I don't include anything that's going to break down naturally anymore. There was a time when I would use fur from coats or whatever I found, mm-hmm. but it breaks down. You know, so unless I was making something that I specifically wanted to break down, you know, as part of, you know, some kind of outdoor performance piece, then I'm going to use synthetic material, mm-hmm. which is important to me because I think we're flooded with, you know, plastic objects. And, you know, for me to use that stuff, it feels like part of, like, our vernacular language. You know, it's there. Mm-hmm. We need to think about it. We need to think about why we have so much of this plastic stuff. You know, mm-hmm. so.
And you're doing your part to see how we could make that beautiful. I mean, it's pretty stunning. I want to ask you about a piece I know a lot of people must ask you about. I first saw it at the Ogden, and that's the horse. That one piece alone, if that's all you ever made, I think would ensure wow. that you're in the anthologies forever. Tell us about that piece. It's an enormous horse.
Yeah, it's a rocking horse, mm-hmm. and it's at least 10 years old. So I was just thinking about, you know, the children's stories, and I was thinking about, you know, when you kids can sometimes get in a zone where you're not at all thinking about what's going on in real life. And, like, I knew somebody as a kid who would, like, rock. You know, they would sit on the sofa and just rock, and the kid would just zone out and, you know, I don't know where she went, but she was. That's how she calmed herself. And I was thinking about, you know, a rocking horse would be that kind of same thing. And you know, of course, I weld as well, but I haven't been making that kind of art in a while. But the rocking horse that we're talking about is made with a lot of different kinds of metal objects that are welded together, and some things that are, you know, kind of tied in there too because they're not metal, but still existing within the same kind of paradigm that I'm talking about our, you know, setting up our filters and our experience makes up our reality. So the actual rocking horse is made up of all these different kinds of things.
Right. So you welded that piece together.
Yeah.
It wasn't a found rocking horse. You created
that.
Oh,
no.
And then did the collage on it as well.
Yeah.
The beads and colors. And what sort of filter were you thinking of? What were these collections on this horse in addition to that idea of rocking back and forth? How did you choose what to include?
Well, part of the decisions were what came to me. I mean, sometimes that happens, you know, what I can actually find that'll work, you know. So I manipulate the what I find to work with my idea, or I will go out and look for specific things. So it goes both ways. And those, I think, that's the vocabulary. I need to find my words, or I need to, you know, use the words that I find.
Mm-hmm. Well, people have the opportunity to see the horse. It is in this exhibit, I believe. You all, it was kindly loaned from the Ogden. What is the title of that piece?
Scared Dragon. It's just from a kid's story.
Mm-hmm. I wondered about that title. So that piece is in there, and there are how many pieces in total, Sean? In the
19, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And how did you choose which pieces?
Well, Lee curated the show, mm-hmm. so she actually did that. She chose everything.
All right. And Lee, what was your, you know, thinking behind the choices you made?
I think it's you look at every artist individually, and you think, what is their strength? And I have a personal preference for showing diversity of what artists. I don't like showing just one piece of anybody. I like to show a multitude because often artists work in series. And so I thought, I know Sean was working on a series of wedding dresses. And so I that was one thing I knew I wanted to include. And some of the larger pieces, that was, you know, definitely because they're powerful. And you want to show the range of an artist. So we also have some of the smallest pieces. I don't know if they're the smallest pieces she's ever made, but some are small. So I think what I was going for was just the idea that this artist has tremendous range. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, you know, show a lot of things from her. So it wasn't just look at one and think that's it.
Mm. The wedding dresses, how many are in this?
Just four.
Four of them.
Three. Okay.
Three. You took wedding dresses, actual wedding dresses, and collaged on the wedding dresses?
Well, I did. I they're such beautiful objects, and then they're worn one time, and then they're, you know, I got these from Goodwill. These are shaped pieces that we're talking about right now, and so they were wedding dresses that I flattened out and then sewed, you know, my stuff on. But I also have been using dresses in general, or prom dresses for the first layer of my recent rectangular pieces. And again, I like to, you know, the first layers need to have something for me to react to. And I was just, with the wedding dresses, I was thinking about all the expectations you have, you know, when you're getting married and what you were. There's a wedding cake as well, a three-dimensional piece that's in the show. And so I was thinking about what your expectations are, and I was thinking, what if, you know, if and when, or if you did get married, you everything you expected and everything that was going to happen to you all had left a mark already on, you know, on what you were wearing or on the cake. And so I kind of went with that. So
again, like a filter.
Right.
Stuck right there. Right. You know, as people are hearing more and more your descriptions of your pieces, I'm sure there are many people out there wondering what your studio looks like, how you know, we've all looked at Martha Stewart or some magazine that shows your home creative crafting place and how you can organize it, you know, little jars with a few buttons in it. And what does yours look like?
Well, first of all, I'm lucky enough to have a large space because I renovated half of a barn. So, you know, which is good for me. I can make big pieces and I can stand back from my work and look at it, which is important. Right now, it's kind of messy. I have a lot. As you could expect, I have a lot of stuff. Normally, I have, you know, they're kept in big cans or buckets or, you know, and they start off organized. But while I'm working on a piece, a lot of it ends up on the floor. I do have two kids that sometimes want to, you know,
play in the beads.
Well, or they work on, if they come in the studio, they have to work on something. So, you know, if they're working on something, sometimes it's, you know, all over the floor.
Sean is enfant. Il est enfant. What an amazing playground for them, too.
Right.
I mean, all these beads and buttons and toys and, yeah. I mean, do you have them arranged by color? And I'm kind of thinking a wonderland.
Some stuff is arranged by color, but, you know, entropy, right? It starts off organized.
And they sort of migrate into other buckets, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, are these like gallon-sized buckets? How large are these containers that you're...
Well, they're like crate size or, you know, plastic bin size. Yeah, you know, small enough to handle, you know.
You have to figure of our curiosity. I know to you it's normal to arrange your... but it's fascinating for us to imagine how that works in your life. And again, for something that gives so many of us so much pleasure to look at, to think how it's created and what goes into it.
Well, increasingly there are buckets of mixed stuff. That's just the way it's going.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's, as you say, a lot of mixing. Even though when you step back, there seems to be form and color when you get close. It's interesting how those boundaries blur a little bit, you know. Again, we're talking about Sean Major's new exhibit that opens at the Hilliard University Art Museum called Rhyme and Reason, The Art of Sean Major. Was that your title, Lee? Or did Sean? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how do you see that? What was your thinking behind the title?
Because there's so much what appears to be chaos that she has organized. Mm-hmm. And so I think, and it actually... It kind of started with the idea of poetry and found poetry and how found poetry is a mix of words and you're finding things here and there and pulling that together in the same way that artists work with assemblage. So it started off with that idea, but the concept of rhyme and reason, there is something that pulls this chaos all together and makes sense of it and becomes something organized and beautiful and... I don't know. I guess organized, just finished, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And does that feel good to you, Sean, that concept in this exhibit?
Yeah, it does. And I think the works are really strong. I mean, formalism is important in all of the pieces. And I think that's the only way that I can deal with that kind of chaos, really. They're tight, but they look loose.
Well, that is on display now at the Hilliard University Art Museum. Mm-hmm. Some people may wonder if there's a place they can go on the web, if you have a website, Facebook, where they can see your work.
Well, seanmajor.com has, okay. I think, all of the work. But come to the museum, and especially come this Friday between 6 and 8 for the opening.
All right, so there's an opening reception to open to the public.
There is this Friday. It's open to everyone, and I think many of the artists will be there, and certainly Sean will be there. I also want to put in a plug for Sean lecturing. It's not until October, but you know we'll come back at that point. But she will be speaking directly, giving a gallery talk about her work. So if people want to come and ask her more questions directly, they can look forward to that. And then we have another, if I may,
yes.
Just mention that there are other artists who will be speaking. The Voices, Louisiana Voices, six artists speak to us. We'll actually have a panel discussion in the gallery on September 29th. And that's at 2 p.m. That's a Saturday. This Friday morning, we actually have Marjorie Pearson, who's going to be speaking about her photography and wetlands research. She teaches a class at Duke University in North Carolina, and she's been working with their wetlands research group and also here. So she's very interested because she's from the New Iberia area. She's very interested in the wetlands, and her photography is about that. So she's speaking at 10 a.m. in the gallery this Friday morning. So please come to that as well.
Okay. Well, all that's listed on your website as well, the Hilliard Museum, and we'll keep announcing it. And we'll look forward to Sean's gallery talk as well. I know anyone who goes to see the exhibit will want to attend that gallery talk and get to ask you about the works and hear what you have to say about them as well. Again, my guest, Sean Major, an exhibit has opened at the Hilliard University Art Museum, along with a number of other exhibits, including many Louisiana artists, as a part of this bicentennial year, a great celebration of our artwork. The Hilliard website is
museum.louisiana.edu.
Good one to bookmark and find out all about the hours of the museum and more information about these exhibits. But the public reception again this Friday from 6 to 8, and Sean will be there, and you can see her works in Gallery A, that larger gallery, and then of course all the other spaces are filled as well. Well, Sean, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time, and we're so glad that we have such an extensive exhibit of your work here in Lafayette.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.